Good afternoon. I'm also going to be timing myself, so I'm not checking my email while I talk. I haven't been able to figure out how to do that yet. I'm happy to be here today. I'm very excited to be part of this presentation for many reasons, including the opportunity to see some of the interesting work being done by other rehabilitation researchers in the field of rehab that's been sponsored by NIH. Let's see. I'd like to acknowledge NIH for funding the study that I'm going to be presenting to you. I'd also like to point out that really a topic near and dear to our heart at the University of Washington is the really thorny problem of chronic pain in persons with disabilities. And NIH funded back in the mid-90s several program projects looking at, you know, what can we do about this problem of chronic pain across disabilities. And so as a result of that funding, that has then spurned other funding that my colleagues, Mark Jensen and others, have been doing at the University of Washington. So I'd like to kind of show how that seed of the program projects has really led to a career for several of us. And hopefully led to improvements in the care for people, or will lead to improvements in the care for people with chronic pain. Nothing to disclose. I'd also like to thank the many study participants who over the years have really endured a lot of different types of research we've done, and I've really learned a lot from them about managing life and living life with chronic pain after disability. So what I'd like to do today is present some preliminary findings from a randomized controlled trial that we've been conducting. We're now currently in about 3.5 years into a 5-year study. Funded by NIH, and we're looking at the efficacy of a telephone-delivered cognitive behavioral therapy intervention for pain in individuals with acquired limb loss, multiple sclerosis, and spinal cord injury. Today I'm going to talk to you a bit about the rationale for and description of the intervention, kind of why we went this direction, some preliminary results regarding efficacy, and talk a bit about feasibility and implementation, because I think that's where it really starts to get into implications for public health. Chronic pain is a significant and serious problem for many persons with disabilities. This slide is my attempt to show just how prevalent the problem is. This is drawing from a number of studies looking at prevalence. And as you can see, in the many disability groups, more than half of people with disability experience chronic pain. And for those who have pain, it's often severe, and more severe than national norms of other chronic pain groups. And it often greatly interferes with participation in valued life activities. The other thing about chronic pain and disability is it tends to be somewhat refractory to medical intervention. Certainly, I'm not trying to say that medical interventions don't have a role and that people don't get some pain relief from pharmacotherapy, for example, or rehabilitation interventions. However, unfortunately, like chronic pain in the broader field, it's often difficult to get enough pain relief for people to really do what they want to be doing in their lives. And so, being psychologists, Mark Jensen and I have been very interested in looking at, you know, kind of how can you apply what we know about chronic pain in the broader chronic pain field and apply it to people with disabilities. And what we know in the broader chronic pain field is that psychosocial factors play a really important role in how people do when they have chronic pain and how they manage chronic pain. So over the last 10 years or so, we've been looking at studies, and other people have also been conducting this type of research. And not surprising, we saw that indeed psychosocial factors are significantly associated with pain and dysfunction in acquired amputation, MS, spinal cord injury, and a few other disability groups. And we recently did a systematic review that was published in 2011, kind of summarizing this. And we found really kind of three areas in particular where psychosocial factors seem to play a role. One of them is what we call catastrophizing cognitions, which simply is kind of how people think about and evaluate their pain. So people who tend to think, I can't manage this, this is difficult, I can't stand this, those kind of unhelpful thoughts, understandable in the face of pain, but when people experience them, they tend to do worse. In contrast, when people cope with pain by persisting with tasks despite pain, they tend to do better, whereas if they guard or protect what hurts or tend to become inactive and rest, they tend to do worse. We also know that the social environment plays a role as well, and that general social support is good, but solicitous responding, where people try to comfort them and specifically try to encourage them to maybe not do things because of pain, that that's unhelpful. So back in the early 2000s, we decided to conduct some research looking at psychosocial treatments. Because we know what we were noticing is even though there's an evidence base suggesting that psychosocial interventions decrease pain and improve functioning in samples where pain is primary, such as back pain, headaches, etc., very few individuals with chronic pain and amputation, MS or SCI, report having tried a psychological intervention for pain. So these interventions, they're really not getting to the people with disabilities. We also conducted an in-person randomized controlled trial funded by NIH where we tried to bring people in to our medical centers to receive a cognitive behavioral intervention for pain. And what we found is that many of them, and in fact in this sample, over half of the people we screened wanted to be in our study, but when we talked about trying to work around logistics of getting them to the various places where we were holding the actual intervention, they weren't able to do it. With transportation being the biggest barrier. And survey research, some of it conducted by a postdoc of mine, Tiara Dilworth, has shown that many people with comorbid chronic pain and disability report inadequate access to pain treatments, including psychosocial treatments. So now I'm going to talk to you about our telephone intervention for pain study, or TIPS, that we've conducted out of the University of Washington. Our study aims first one was to evaluate the efficacy of a telephone-delivered CBT, which cognitive behavioral therapy, which is kind of the best accepted currently intervention for pain in the broader population. So we wanted to test that efficacy of that in persons with limb loss, MS, or spinal cord injury. And then we also, our second aim, wanted to look at potential mediators and moderators of treatment effects. Today I'll be primarily focusing on the first one because, as I said, we're almost done with actually collecting, enrolling participants, but we have not yet started to look at number two. Our inclusion criteria include that they needed to have a definitive diagnosis of limb loss, MS, or SCI confirmed by participant's provider. In past studies, we didn't take this step, and what we had found is sometimes people would show up for our pain interventions and not actually have a spinal cord injury, or they not actually have the intervention, the condition that we thought. So given it was telephone, we decided we had to be particularly careful, and thus we'd have them give us consent to contact a provider, and we would get that confirmed. We also wanted to enroll people where pain was truly a problem for them. So we asked, we enrolled people who had an average pain intensity in the past month of greater than 3 on a 0 to 10 numeric rating scale. And they also needed to have pain of at least 6 months duration, and the pain needed to be present part of the day, more than half the day. Although we really wanted to not exclude too many people with potential cognitive difficulties, we did feel it was important to screen out people who maybe had just were simply going to be unable to participate due to cognitive impairment, due to the heavy demands of trying to learn strategies over the phone. So we used a 6-item screener to really screen out only those with the most severe impairments. And then we also excluded people who are previously or currently participating in a similar type of intervention. All of our measures were administered at pre-treatment, mid, and post-treatment, and then 3, 6, and 12-month follow-ups. Our primary outcome is average pain intensity in the past week. We asked them to rate their pain intensity 4 different times within a period of a week, and we asked them to rate the past 24 hours using the 0 to 10 scale, and then we put this together to form a simple composite measure of average pain intensity in the past week. Although I won't go into our secondary outcomes too much today, we are very interested in looking at other outcomes, in particular how much pain interferes with their lives, depression, their global rating of improvement, and we'll be looking at, again, mechanisms of treatment such as several mediators and process variables to really try to understand if the treatments work, kind of what might be going into that. So participants are randomly assigned after our baseline data collection and before session one to one of two interventions, which I'll describe for you briefly in a moment, a telephone-delivered cognitive behavioral therapy or a telephone-delivered pain education. And we do a number of things to really ensure the fidelity of the treatments, that what we're delivering is pretty consistent across therapists, and that we really trying to uphold what the interventions are about. They participate in 8 weekly 50 to 60 minute sessions, all conducted by phone at a scheduled time. And then we also have the clinicians or study therapists do booster calls at several time points up to 24 weeks post-treatment to really try to help them maintain any gains and problem-solve difficulties they run into. The intervention is delivered by either postdoctoral fellows or clinical psychologists supervised by Dr. Judy Turner and myself. And we really try to conduct these sessions as if they were face-to-face. And we do that in a number of ways I'll tell you about. Going the wrong direction. One of the things we really try to do in the first session is we talk with them about how even though this is by phone, we are going to kind of hold these appointments sacred as if you would if you were visiting a healthcare provider. I mean, we're going to be on time. We expect them to be on time. And we do a number of things to really be respectful of the time that they're putting into it as a way to try to make the telephone seem like a more natural way to receive healthcare. And we do that for both groups. In terms of the CBT, they receive training in relaxation strategies adapted for various types of disability. We have 7 different relaxation exercises that are all available to them via a CD or MP3 files. That we do a lot of goal setting and behavioral activation, trying to help them, set achievable goals to get them out into the world and doing more things despite pain. We talk to them about pacing of activities so they learn not to under or overdo it. And then because catastrophizing cognitions are such a huge predictor of poor outcomes in people with pain, we really have a heavy cognitive therapy component where we try to help them to learn how to identify and change unhelpful cognitions or thoughts. There's lots of in-session rehearsal of skills, there's readings, and there's lots of homework outside of the sessions. We decided to do really an active comparison intervention because we wanted to make sure that if we got effects, it wasn't simply because they had a nice person to talk to on the phone once a week. So we decided to take really a lot of kind of state-of-the-art information about chronic pain and put it into an educational intervention tailored to disability. And so the education group really got 8 sessions of support and information. It was very interactive. They also had MP3 files or CDs of readings that they could listen to and also homework. However, the education did not include some of the CBT components or kind of the rehearsal of actual pain self-management skills. We did a number of things to adapt the study procedures to disability and to the telephone. Everything occurred via telephone, mail, email, or fax. We provided the participants with headsets and response keys so when they were doing their outcome assessments, they could look at the answers and readily respond. We really tried to help them problem solve technical issues with cell phones. Even though it's a low-tech intervention, we still ran into a number of challenges there. And we provided them with very detailed and organized manuals and multiple formats to try to make it adapted to people. So, for example, we had large print versions, PDFs, et cetera. And we really made a point to have the therapist deliberately query each participant at the beginning as to whether or not they thought they could do the homework we were asking them to do. And if not, we would kind of help them problem solve what to do about that. And what you see on this slide is, it's small print, I apologize, but this is just one example from the CBT group of a TIPS personal plan or a pain management plan. So we really tried to have them use self-monitoring and other things to really have a place where they could focus on implementing their pain self-management skills. So this slide, I'm turning to results now. This slide is my research staff's favorite slide. It's a map of the U.S. and all of the states in gray are where we got at least one participant. And we actually had 2 Canadians sneak into the study as well before we caught on. We, as of the 1st of October, we have enrolled 160 people. Our target is 200. We have about 20 to 25 people in the pipeline right now, mostly people with AMP and SCI who are going to be, are pretty close to being fully enrolled or in the stages of getting scheduled. So we're actually right on target, if not ahead of schedule, in terms of recruitment, which if you've ever done a randomized controlled trial, you know that is highly unusual. And we've really been trying to do national recruitment because we're not limited to our local region. And so one of the things that stood out to us is how receptive people have been to the study. Just one brief example, when we first started this study, we had a very brief one-sentence mention in the MS Momentum magazine, which is a consumer-based magazine for individuals with multiple sclerosis, and we had our phone number, and within about a week, we had over 200 calls of people wanting to know more and be in the study, and we actually had to start a wait list for the study for MS. And in fact, are not going to be able to enroll everybody who's expressed interest. And again, that's just highly unusual anytime you're doing a trial, or at least in my experience. We did take a look at pain intensity for our preliminary. So I'm going to present these data to you, but we've chosen not to look at our secondary outcomes at this point since we are still enrolling. But what you see on this slide is the purple line is the CBT from pre to mid to post treatment. For pain, average pain intensity in the past week, and the green line is our education. You can see both groups were even. They started out at about a 5.5 on the 0 to 10 scale, and then they, however, over time, the CBT group has a much greater, and this is statistically significant, greater change or decrease in pain from pre to post-treatment as a group. And they went from about a 5.5 to a 3.5 on average, which in the pain clinical trial literature, anytime you achieve over a 30% reduction in pain intensity, you're thought to have had a pretty good outcome. So this is considered a clinically significant or clinically meaningful outcome in pain intensity, which was very encouraging because, to be honest, I don't know if we thought we'd change intensity as much as we were hoping to change some of our other outcomes like pain interference or depression. So we're pleased by this. And this was after 125 participants. The other data I want to show you are some of the data from our treatment satisfaction, because I think it speaks to kind of some of the potential public health implications and telehealth implications. We asked participants in both groups to rate using a 0 to 10 scale how helpful and convenient the interventions were, and I did not look at these differently, but they're quite similar across both, or I didn't present them by group, but they're quite similar when you compare the two groups. And as you can see, they rated it very highly in terms of its helpfulness and quite highly in terms of the intervention's convenience. We asked them if they'd recommend the tips, the interventions, to a friend who had pain and disability, and 97% said they would. Probably even more striking, our attrition has been less than 5%. And adherence, we've had 88% of folks who enrolled in the study attended all 8 sessions of the interventions. We asked them some open-ended questions about delivery because we're kind of curious, like, which direction should we go and what works best from their perspective. And we asked them, if given the choice, what is your preferred method of treatment delivery? And as you see on this slide, you know, some people would still prefer being in person or other options such as the web. But nonetheless, I thought it was interesting to see, you know, that they might have other options and yet they're still reporting, you know, quite a bit of interest in the current study. We also asked them about benefits and drawbacks to the telephone delivery, and you see what you see on this slide are the benefits on the left and the drawbacks on the right. And not surprisingly, a lot of them commented on it was easier, it didn't have as much traveling. Almost a third said they thought a benefit was that they didn't have to dress up. And one of the things my therapist has actually commented on is how they can do their phone therapy from their in their blue jeans, or a few of them even from their pajamas from home. So it's a benefit for both. In terms of drawbacks, only 71% of the sample reported that they didn't see any drawbacks to telephone delivery, although about a fourth said that they thought it was a drawback not to have face-to-face communication or to see their therapist. And then last, I want to just show you what our results so far on therapeutic alliance. Therapeutic alliance is essentially the construct in the psychotherapy literature that has to do with the therapeutic relationship between the therapist and the individual. And we were interested in seeing, you know, if you use a telephone, do you lose some of that therapeutic alliance? Do people maybe feel not quite as connected to their therapist? And what you see on this slide is actually that we have very high therapeutic alliance for both groups. The scale is a 1 to 7 mean score for the scale. And you see at mid-treatment, because we don't measure them at the beginning of treatment because they haven't had much experience with the therapist, but at mid and post-treatment, they both groups rate very high therapeutic alliance. And these numbers are actually quite similar to in-person psychotherapy trials using the same scale, as well as the telephone-delivered CBT for depression in people with MS by David Moore. So I think this suggests that they're able to kind of get past the barrier and relate to their therapist. And maybe the last thing I should point out about that last slide is that in the psychotherapy literature, we do know that, in fact, high therapeutic alliance is associated with better outcomes in psychotherapy studies. So in terms of our conclusions thus far, I think our results to date really support the feasibility and acceptance of a telehealth pain intervention in persons with disabilities. The results suggest, again, that therapeutic alliance is high and does not appear to be compromised by the use of the phone, and that telehealth interventions for chronic pain hold a lot of promise for addressing issues of access. In terms of our future directions, and not only maybe what we do, but what we'd like to see, is we'd like to see more work continue to be done that's really looking at that chasm between randomized controlled trials and implementation of pain interventions in real-world settings. And we'd like to see more research on telehealth to try to use that, again, as a way to improve access. We're also interested in mechanisms of effects. You know, if we can learn more about why our treatments work and what aspects don't work, that will allow us to better tailor treatments and target treatments. And I'd also like to see more effectiveness research done for this vaccine problem of chronic pain. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and attention.